Please, Robert said from the stove. Drink the beer. It doesn't bother me. In fact, it would bother me more if you didn't. Catherine looked at the clock, 12:20. Time out of time. Once again, the envelope began to open. It was a Friday. Normally, she would be at school, fifth period. Normally, she would not be drinking a beer. Although it was Christmas vacation, she thought. She was theoretically not due back until the 2nd of January. She had given no thought to how she would manage in the classroom. An image of students moving in a hallway rose to the surface, but she banished it. At 5 minutes before noon, Robert had turned off all the ringers on the telephones. There was nothing so urgent it couldn't wait an hour or two, he had said, and she had agreed. In that spirit, she had covered the table near the windows in the front room with a red-flowered cloth, the gaiety of the cloth incongruous against the somber sky outside. Robert put on music, B.B. King. Catherine wished she had flowers. But what exactly was she celebrating, she wondered, feeling vaguely guilty. Having survived the last 11 days? Having cleaned the house? She set utensils, bowls for the shells, bread, melted butter, and a thick roll of paper towel on the table. Robert walked into the front room from the kitchen bearing wet, slippery plates of lobsters. There were water spots on the front of his shirt. I'm famished, he said, setting the plates down and sitting across from her. She examined the lobster in front of her, and it was then that the swift, sharp shock of memory once again assailed her. She looked up quickly and then out the window. She brought a hand to her mouth. What is it? Robert asked. She shook her head quickly, side to side. She held herself still, locked in an image, not daring to move either forward or backward for fear of the crevices. She breathed in deeply, let her breath out, laid her arms on the table. I've just had a memory, she said. What is it? Jack and me. Here? She nodded. Doing this? It was like this, she wanted to say, but not like this. It was early summer and the screens were on. Maddie was at a friend's house, and it was later in the day, nearer 4 o'clock or 5. The light was unique, she remembered, shimmery and green like sea glass. They had had champagne. What were they celebrating? She couldn't remember. Possibly nothing, possibly themselves. She had wanted to make love, she remembered, and so had he, but neither of them would sacrifice a hot, boiled lobster. And so they had waited, with a kind of delicious tension between them. She had sucked the legs of her lobster with exaggerated kisses, and Jack had laughed and said she was a tease, which she enjoyed, being a tease. She seldom did that. I'm sorry, Robert said. I should have known. I'll take these into the kitchen. No, she said quickly, stopping his hand as he reached for her plate. No, you couldn't have known. And anyway, my life is filled with these. Hundreds of little memories that catch me off guard. They're like mines in a field waiting to detonate. Honestly, I'd like to have a lobotomy. He moved his hand from under hers and laid it over her fingers. He held her hand in the way a man might hold the hand of a woman friend, waiting for a small crisis to blow over. His hand felt warm because Catherine's had suddenly gone cold. All her memories did this to her. They made the blood leave her hands and feet, like fear did. You've been good to me, she said. Time passed. How much? She could no longer gauge seconds, minutes. She closed her eyes. The beer had made her slightly sleepy. She wanted to turn her hand over, to have him touch her palm, to slide his hand along her palm and up her wrist. She imagined she could feel the warmth of his hand traveling along the underside of her arm, past the elbow. Her fingers under Robert's went slack, and she felt the tension drain from her body. It was erotic, but not. That loosening, that giving up. Her eyes seemed to have unfocused themselves, and she couldn't see Robert or anything else properly, only a sense of light from the windows. That light, diffuse and dimmed, created an aura of languid ease. And she thought that she ought to feel disturbed for thinking of Robert and herself in that way, but a kind of leniency seemed to have descended upon them with the haze, and she felt merely vague and drifting. So much so that when Robert, perhaps in an effort to bring her back, tightened the pressure on her hand, she felt jolted into the present moment. "You're like a kind of priest," she said. He laughed. "No, I'm not. I think that's how I've come to see you." "Father Robert," he said, smiling. And then she thought, who was to know if this man's hand traveled up the inside of her arm? Who was to care? Weren't all of the rules now broken? Hadn't Maddie said so? The silence of the steady snowfall enclosed them. She could see that he was struggling to understand precisely where she was and why, but she couldn't help him because she herself didn't know. The front room was always slightly too cold in winter, she thought, and she shivered once in spite of the steam she could hear rushing into the radiators. Outside, the sky was becoming so dark, it might have been mistaken for dusk. He withdrew his hand, leaving hers uncovered. She felt exposed. She drank another bottle of beer. Between them, they ate all of the bread and the lobsters. In the middle of the meal, Robert got up and changed the CD from B.B. King to Brahms. "You have wonderful music," he said when he returned. "You're interested in music?" "Yes." "What kind?" "Piano, especially. Was the music Jack's or yours?" he asked, sitting down. She cocked her head, not certain she understood what he meant. "Usually the CDs and the sound system are the passion of either the husband or the wife, but not both," he explained, "at least in my experience." She thought about this. "Mine," she said. "Jack was tone deaf, but he liked rock and roll, and some of Maddie's music, for the beat, I think. What about you?" "Mine too," he said. "Although my ex-wife kept the sound system and most of the CDs. One of my sons has inherited an ear. He plays the saxophone at school. The other one seems to have no interest." "Maddie plays the clarinet. I tried to get her to play the piano," Catherine said, "but it was torture." Catherine thought about all of the hours she had spent with Maddie at the piano, Maddie clearly not wanting to be there, exaggerating her nearly pathological reluctance by having obsessively to scratch her back where she couldn't quite reach, or adjust the bench, or take an inordinately long time finding her fingering. It was an effort just to get Maddie to play a song once, never mind actually practice the piece several times. Often, Catherine had ended up having to leave the room in a barely restrained rage, at which point Maddie would begin to cry. Before the first year was out, Catherine could see that if she insisted Maddie keep on with the lessons, their relationship would be in tatters. Now, of course, Maddie was almost never without her music, in her room, in the car, and plugged into headphones as if they delivered oxygen through the ears. "You play?" Catherine asked. "Used to." She studied him and added a small detail to a portrait that had been forming since the day he'd entered her house. It was what one did with people, Catherine thought. Form portraits, fill in missing brush strokes, wait for form and color to materialize. He dipped a piece of tail in butter and brought it dripping to his mouth. "The night before Jack left for his trip," Catherine said, "he went into Maddie's room and asked her if she wanted to go to a Celtics game with him on Friday night. A friend had given him really good seats. What I want to know is this. Would a man ask his daughter to go with him to a Celtics game if he planned to kill himself before he got back?" Robert wiped his chin and thought a minute. "Would a man who had really good seats to a Celtics game kill himself before he got to see the game?" Her eyes widened. I'm sorry, he said quickly. No, it doesn't make any sense, not in any realm of human nature I've ever heard of. And Jack told me to call Alfred, Catherine said. He told me to have Alfred come on Friday to fix the leaky shower. If Jack wasn't planning on coming back, he wouldn't have done that. Not in the way he did it, almost as an afterthought as he walked to the car. And he'd have been different with me. He'd have said goodbye differently. I know he would. There'd be one small thing that maybe wouldn't register at the time, but would after the fact. Something. Robert reached for his water glass and pushed himself slightly away from the table. Do you remember, she asked, when the safety board questioned me, they asked me if Jack had any close friends in England? Yes. She stared at the bowl of discarded shells. I've just had a thought, she said. I'll be right back. As she climbed the stairs, she tried to recall if she had done that particular wash. She'd worn the jeans for 2 days and then thrown them in the hamper. But not her own hamper, she remembered, Maddie's hamper. And Catherine hadn't done any wash at all of Maddie's because Maddie hadn't been there. Any laundry Maddie had needed had been done at Julia's. She found the jeans at the bottom of the pile of soiled laundry, buried beneath clothes Robert and she had tossed into the hamper just hours ago. She removed the handful of papers and receipts, which were slightly damp from a long-buried towel. When she returned to the front room, Robert was contemplating the snowfall. He watched her as she pushed her plate away and unfolded the papers. Look at this, she said, handing the lottery ticket to Robert. I found these papers wadded up in the pocket of Jack's jeans on the back of the bathroom door on the day he died. I didn't think much of them at the time and just stuck them in the pocket of my own jeans. But do you see that notation, M at A's, and the numbers following it? What does it look like to you? Robert studied the number, and she could see from the flicker of his eyes that he understood what she was thinking. A UK phone number, you think, he said. It's a London exchange, isn't it? The 181? I think so. Isn't that the right number of digits? I'm not sure. Let me see, she said. She put out her hand and Robert gave her back the ticket, though not without a certain reluctance. I'm curious, she said, defending herself. If it's a phone number, why is it written on this ticket? And this is recent. He must have bought this ticket the day before he left. She looked at the ticket's date. Yes, he did, she said. December 14th. This was a perfectly reasonable thing to do, she thought, as she walked to the telephone by the sofa. She picked up the receiver and tapped in the numbers. Almost immediately, she could hear a distinctly foreign ring, a sound that always put her in mind of old-fashioned Parisian telephones with spindly black cradles. A voice answered at the other end, and Catherine, startled by the voice, unprepared for it, glanced quickly up at Robert. She'd given no thought at all to what she wanted to say. A woman said hello again, this time in a slightly irritated voice. Not an old woman, not a girl. Catherine searched for a name. She wanted to ask, did you ever know a man named Jack Lyons? But the question suddenly seemed absurd. I must have the wrong number, Catherine said quickly. Sorry to have bothered you. Who is this? The woman asked, wary now. Catherine couldn't bring herself to say her name. There was the click of a phone hung up in annoyance, followed by silence. Her hands shaking badly, Catherine replaced the receiver and sat down. She felt rattled much in the same way she once had as a girl in junior high school when she had called a boy she liked but hadn't been able to say her name. Let this go, Robert said quietly from the table. Catherine rubbed her hands along the thighs of her jeans to stop their trembling. Listen, she said. Can you find out something for me? What? Could you find out the names of all of the crew Jack has ever flown with? Why? He asked. I might be able to recognize a name if I saw it, or put a name to a face I've once seen. If that's what you want, he said slowly. It's hard to know what I want, she said. While Robert went up to Jack's office to get the crew list, Catherine spread out all of the other papers from the crumpled wad and scanned them. She noticed particularly the receipt from the post office for a $22 purchase. Perhaps it was not for stamps, she thought, peering at the receipt more closely. She opened up the piece of white-lined paper and looked at the lines of poetry Jack had copied. Here in the narrow passage and the pitiless north, perpetual betrayals, relentless, resultless fighting. A random fury of Dirks in the dark, a struggle for survival of hungry, blind cells of life in the womb. What did the poem mean? She glanced up at the whiteout beyond the windows. Already there was a significant accumulation on the lawn, and she thought she should probably call Julia to make sure she and Maddie were okay. She wondered if Maddie was up yet. She unfolded the second piece of lined paper, the remember list. Bergdorf, FedEx robe to arrive 20th. Odd, she thought, but a FedEx package had not come on the 20th. She was certain of that. Rising from the table, she once again pondered the significance of the lines of poetry. They meant little to her now, but perhaps she could find the whole poem, and that would suggest an idea to her. She walked over to the bookshelf. It was little more than a tall tier of wooden planks, stretching nearly to the ceiling. Jack had read books about airplanes and biographies about men, sometimes a novel with a clever plot. For her part, Catherine mostly read fiction written by women, usually contemporary novels, although she had a special fondness for Edith Wharton and Willa Cather. She searched for an old anthology of poetry and found it on the bottom shelf. She sat on the edge of the sofa. She propped the book on her lap and began to turn the pages. When nothing immediately revealed itself, she decided to start at the beginning with the intention of turning each page until she had found the lines she was looking for. But it quickly became clear to her that she wouldn't have to do that. The early poems were ancient. Using the language in the lines of the poem as a guide, she opened the book about halfway through. There, the verse was by poets who wrote in a syntax similar to the lines she had in her hand. She began methodically to make her way through the pages when Robert called to her from Jack's office. Outside, the snow was thickening steadily, falling against the windows in swift cascades. The forecasters were predicting 6 to 8 inches, Robert had said. At least Catherine knew where Maddie was and that she wouldn't be going out in a car. She put the book down and went up to Jack's office, where Robert was seated at the desk. In his hands, he held the shiny paper of a fax. And she realized suddenly, as she saw him sitting in Jack's chair, that Robert knew what was on the tape. Of course he did. Tell me about the tape, she said. This is a list of all the people Jack ever flew with at Vision, he said, handing her the fax. Thank you, she said, taking the list from him but not looking at it. She could see that he hadn't thought she would ask. Please, she said, tell me what you know. He crossed his arms and rolled the chair away from the desk, putting a little distance between them. I haven't heard the tape itself, he said. None of us has. No, I know that. I can only tell you what I've been told by a friend of mine who works with me at the union. I know. You really want to hear this? Yes, she said. Although she didn't know, she couldn't be sure. How could she be sure she wanted to hear it until she'd heard it? He stood abruptly and walked to the window, his back to Catherine. He spoke briskly, in a businesslike manner, as though to strip the words of any emotional content. The flight is normal until 56 minutes into it, he said. Jack is apparently taken short. Taken short? He leaves the cockpit at 56 minutes and 14 seconds into the flight. He doesn't say what's wrong, only that he will be right back. They, the people who have heard the tape, assume he went into the bathroom. He turned to look in her direction, though not quite at her. She nodded. 2 minutes later, First Officer Roger Martin announces he's having trouble with his headset. He asks to borrow those of Trevor Sullivan, the engineer. Sullivan hands Martin his own headset and says, "Try these." Martin tries the engineer's headset, finds Sullivan's works just fine, and says to him, "Well, it's not the plug. My headset must be bad." "Roger Martin's headphones are bad," Catherine said. "Yes." So Martin gives Sullivan his headset back, and then Sullivan says, "Here, wait a minute. Maybe Lyons has a spare." Apparently, Sullivan then unfastens his seatbelt and reaches over into Jack's flight bag. You know where the flight bags are stowed? Beside the pilots? On the outside bulkhead beside each pilot, yes. And Sullivan must then pull out something from Jack's flight bag that he doesn't recognize because he says, "What the hell?" It's something he didn't expect. It seems that way. Not headphones. We don't know. And then? And then Jack enters the cockpit. Sullivan says, "Lyons, is this a joke?" Robert paused. He leaned against the windowsill, half sitting. "There may have been a scuffle here," Robert said. "I've heard conflicting reports, but if there was, it was quick," because Sullivan says almost immediately, "What the fuck?" "And?" And then he says, "Jesus Christ." "Who says Jesus Christ?" "Sullivan." "And?" And that's all. No one says anything else? The tape ends. She tilted her head toward the ceiling, contemplating what the end of the tape meant. "He had a bomb in his flight bag," she said quietly. "An armed bomb. That's why they think suicide." Robert stood. He put his hands in his pockets. "Even one phrase different," Robert said, "and the whole tape could mean something else. Even with the words exactly as I've just said them, the tape doesn't necessarily mean anything. You know that. We've talked about that." "Do they know for sure Jack was in the cockpit at the time?" They can hear the latch of the cockpit door opening and closing, after which Sullivan addresses him specifically. "What I don't understand," she said, "is how Jack could possibly have something that dangerous in his flight bag." "Actually," Robert said, "that's the easy part." He turned to look out at the snow. "It's harmless, absolutely harmless. Everyone does it." "Does what?" "A lot of international pilots do it, almost every flight attendant I've ever known," Robert said. "Usually it's jewelry, gold and silver, sometimes gems." She wasn't sure she understood. She thought of the jewelry she had received from Jack over the years, a thin gold bracelet on an anniversary, a gold S chain for a birthday, diamond-studded earrings once for Christmas. 100 times in and out of an airport, you get to know the security people pretty well, Robert said. They chat about their families and they wave you through. It's a courtesy. When I was flying, I probably had to show my passport 1 time in 50, and customs almost never looked in my flight bag. Catherine shook her head. "I had no idea," she said. "Jack never said." "Some of the pilots, they keep it to themselves. I guess if what you're bringing in is a present, it spoils the gift if the wife knows you smuggled it past customs. I don't know." "Did you do it?" she asked. "Always at Christmas," he said. "That would be the question when you met in the lobby to take the van to the airport. What'd you get the wife?" She put her hands into the pockets of her jeans. She stood with her shoulders hunched. "Why doesn't Jack say anything on the tape?" Catherine asked. "If he didn't know it was a bomb, he'd have been just as surprised as Trevor Sullivan. He'd have said something. He'd have said, 'What are you talking about?' He'd have exclaimed or shouted." Not necessarily. Jack lied about his mother, Catherine said. So? He didn't sleep in the crew apartment, she said. It's not enough. Someone put a bomb on the plane, she said. If it was a bomb, someone put it there, I'll grant you that. And Jack must have known about it, she said. It was his flight bag. I won't grant you that. The Moroccan pilot committed suicide, she said. That was entirely different. How do we know it was different? You're just playing devil's advocate, Robert said to her with some heat. You don't really believe Jack did this. Robert sighed with frustration and turned his back to her. You wanted to know about the tape, he said, and so I told you. She unfolded the facts that she'd tucked under her arm. There were a great many names, 9 or 10 pages of names, beginning with Jack's most recent crew and receding in time until 1986, the year he had started with the airline. She looked at the list. Christopher Haverstraw, Paul Kennedy, Michael DeSantis, Richard Goldthwaite. Occasionally a face would appear, a man or woman she and Jack had once had dinner with, or someone she'd met at a party, although most of the names were unknown to her, and half of them lived in England. In that way, she thought, the life of a vision pilot was an odd one, an almost antisocial profession. Members of a crew Jack flew with might live 50 miles away or across the ocean. And then, on a list dated 1992, she saw the name she hadn't even realized she'd been looking for, the unusual name that rose right up from the paper and traveled through her bones with a charge. Muir Boland, flight attendant. Catherine spoke the name aloud. Muir Boland. She was pretty sure it was a woman's name. She wondered if it was French and whether she was pronouncing it correctly. Catherine reached down in front of her and opened the large drawer of Jack's desk. The junk mail envelope with the name penciled in a corner wasn't there, but she could see it just as clearly as she could see the typed name on the list she held in her hands. Muir 330, the hastily scrawled note had read, on an envelope. A solicitation from Baybank. Knowing instinctively that if she hesitated, she'd be paralyzed with indecision, Catherine took the lottery ticket out of her pocket and laid it on Jack's desk. She lifted up the telephone and once again punched in the number written on it. A voice answered, the same voice as before. Hello, Catherine said quickly, is Muir there? Who? Catherine repeated the name. Oh, you mean Mura, the voice at the other end said, and Catherine heard the corrected pronunciation, Mura, with a bit of a drum roll on the R. No, the woman said. Oh, sorry, Catherine said, feeling a tremendous rush of relief. She wanted only to get off the phone now. Mura was here, the English voice said, but she's gone back to her own place. Are you a friend? Catherine couldn't answer her. She sat heavily in the chair. Who is this? The woman in London asked. Catherine opened her mouth but couldn't say her name. She pressed the receiver to her chest. M at A's, the lottery ticket in front of her read. Muira, 330, the junk mail envelope had read. Two notations in Jack's hand, written 4 years apart and connected with a phone call. Robert took the receiver from her and placed it back on its cradle. What made you ask for Muira? He asked quietly. You've gone white. Just a guess, she said. Who was the woman called Muira, and what was Jack's connection to her? Might he have spent his last night with this woman? Had Jack been having an affair? The questions pushed against her chest, threatening to suffocate her. She thought about all the jokes people routinely made about airline pilots and flight attendants. She had always dismissed the jokes as if no real pilot would be so obvious. Robert, can you find out anything more about one particular name, she asked, where a person lives? If you're sure that's what you want, he said. This is hell, she said. Then leave it alone. She thought about the possibility of leaving this alone. Would you be able to? She asked. She wanted to watch TV, Julia was saying. I had to think of something else instead. Someone once gave me Witness for Christmas. Robert had left the office. Catherine thought he might be washing dishes. Jack did. Well, she seems involved. She woke up at 2. She's eaten. Don't let her watch the TV, Catherine said. I'm serious. Cut the cable if you have to. Catherine swiveled in the office chair and gazed out at a rising snow line on the outside windowsill. It looked like water in a fish tank. Mira was here, a voice had said. Robert is with you? Julia asked. Yes. He came here, you know. I know. Then you know about the crew apartment? Yes. Catherine drew a leg up, wrapped an arm around her knee. 2 notations, 4 years apart, connected by a single initial. Catherine felt a squeeze of anxiety, one that immediately produced beads of sweat on her forehead. Don't lose your faith, Julia said. What faith would that be, exactly? You know what I mean. I'm trying not to. They've revised the forecast, Julia said, 10 to 12. I'd better come now, Catherine said, wiping her forehead with her sleeve. Don't be silly. Don't go out if you don't have to. Have you got food? Just like Julia to think of food. I've eaten, Catherine said. Can I talk to Maddie? There was a silence at the other end of the line. You know, Julia said carefully, Maddie's occupied. She's fine. If you talk to her, she'll just get sad and distant again. She needs to rest for a few days, just watch videos and eat popcorn. It's like a drug, and she needs it for as long as possible. She needs to heal, Catherine. But I'd like to be with her, Catherine protested. Catherine, you've been with her every minute of every day for 10 days. You understand that just by your presence, you're tearing each other apart? You can't bear her grief, and she can't bear to think of how much you're hurting. You don't normally spend time with her like that. This isn't normally. Well, maybe we could all use a bit of normally right now, Julia said. Catherine walked to the window and wiped away the condensation that had formed on the panes. The snow was indeed thick, and the driveway had not been plowed. There must have been 8 inches already on the cars. She sighed. It was always difficult to refute Julia's wisdom, especially as Julia so often turned out to be right. Don't leave the house, Julia repeated. Through the long afternoon, the snow fell steadily, thickening as it did so. From time to time, the wind whistled and howled, but then seemed almost immediately to subside, as though the storm were giving up its attempt to become a blizzard. While Robert made calls from Jack's office, Catherine meandered from one room to another, looking at the walls and out the windows, crossing her arms, uncrossing them, then wandering into a different room and standing in it and staring at the walls or out the windows again. Lately, just standing and thinking had sometimes been all she could manage. After a time, she found herself in the bathroom. She took off her clothes and turned on the shower, letting the water heat up until it was almost scalding. When she stepped in, she bent the back of her neck to the spray and stood in that attitude for a long time. It was such a pleasurable sensation that she stood there until the hot water tank had emptied itself and the water turned cool. When she shut the water off, she could hear music, not a CD, although it was piano music. She adjusted the collar of a long gray bathrobe, a brushed cotton that fell to her ankles. An ancient woman stared at her from the mirror, a washed-out face with hollow eyes. Brushing her hair as she walked, she followed the music down the stairs and into the front room, where Robert was playing the piano. She knew the piece, Chopin. She lay down on the sofa, folding the robe closed over her lap and legs. She shut her eyes. Fantaisie Impromptu was a lavish piece, unabashedly pretty, with an extravagant number of notes. Robert played it as she seldom heard it, without sentimentality, yet it carried with it the delicious weight of stirred memories and forgotten secrets. When she heard the glissandi, she thought of scattered diamonds. The piano stood in the corner, sideways to the windows. Robert had rolled his sleeves, and she watched first his hands and then his forearms. There was something about the hush of snow that improved the acoustics in the room, or perhaps it was that there was no competition from any other noise. The piano sounded better than she remembered, even though it had not been tuned in months. It must have been like this years ago, she thought, listening to Robert play. No television, no radio, no videos, just the space of a long white afternoon in which to make one's own time, one's own sound. And it was safe. She could put her mind elsewhere, not think about the crash or Jack or Maddie. The piano hadn't been something she and Jack had ever shared. It had been Catherine's alone, a solitary pursuit, though a link to Julia, who was also safe. I had no idea, she said when he had finished. It's been a while, he said, turning to her. You're a romantic, she said, smiling. A closet romantic. You play wonderfully. Thank you. Play something else? She saw then, in a way she hadn't quite before, that Robert was a man with a past. Of course he was. He had an entire life she knew almost nothing about. A life during which he'd mastered the piano, learned to fly, become a drunk, married, had children, divorced his wife, and then had somehow become involved in his extraordinary job. She recognized the tune, The Shadow of Your Smile, changing the mood in an instant. When he had finished, he scratched the back of his neck and looked out at the snow. There must be a foot at least out there, he said. The driveway's not plowed, she said. What time is it? He looked at his watch. 3, he said. I think I'll go for a walk. In this? Just to the end of the driveway and back. I need some air. I hope you know you don't have to go to the inn tonight. There are plenty of beds in this house, a lot of rooms. You can sleep on the day bed in my spare room, she added. It's comfortable there. That's what it's for. For hiding, you said. Yes. The information you asked me for is on Jack's desk, he said. She started to speak, but he shook his head. Of all people, he said, this should not have happened to you. Catherine dozed on the couch for a few minutes and then somewhat groggily climbed up to the bedroom with the idea of slipping into the bed and taking a long nap. She took the book of poetry with her. She lay on the bed on her stomach and began to turn the pages, half-heartedly looking for the lines. She read bits of poems by Gerard Manley Hopkins and Wordsworth and Keats. About halfway through the book, the word betrayals suddenly caught her eye, and she realized she had found the correct poem. But then almost immediately, before she could even read the lines through, she saw a faint notation along the inner margin. M, written in pencil, lightly, with an exclamation point. And there, unmistakably there. She sat up sharply and looked closely at the poem, reading it through. The poem was called Antrim and was written by Robinson Jeffers. It seemed to be about ancient struggles on one small patch of land, presumably Antrim, about blood spilled for many causes, various ambushes and betrayals, the patriotism itself and the bodies sacrificed, all turned now to dust, the dust waiting for a resurrection. What did it mean? She let the book fall over the side of the bed and onto the floor. She lay down again and rolled her face into the pillow. She felt as though she had traveled 1,000 miles. When she woke, she glanced instinctively at the clock on her bedside table. It was 3:30 in the morning. She had slept 9 hours. What day was it anyway? The 28th? The 29th? She twisted herself off the bed and half staggered out into the hallway. The door to the spare room was shut. Robert must have returned from his walk and gone in there to sleep, she thought. Or had he had a meal, watched television, read a book? In the kitchen, there were no signs of anyone having cooked a meal. Catherine made a pot of coffee and poured herself a cup. Through the windows over the sink, she could see it had stopped snowing. She moved to the back door and opened it, and was immediately hit with a chilled spray of fine powder that fell from the eave. She blinked and shook her head. Adjusting to the darkness, she saw that the world was shrouded in a thick quilt of white, a candlewick quilt with shallow stitching, so that the trees and shrubs and cars were simply mounded humps. Indeed, there seemed to be so much snow that she wondered if the predictions of 12 inches hadn't been wildly optimistic. She closed the door and leaned against it. M at A's. Mura, 3:30. M. Drawing her robe more tightly around herself, Catherine quickly climbed the stairs to Jack's office, its dusty emptiness still a surprise. She saw the paper Robert had spoken of on Jack's desk. Mura Boland, she read, had left the airline in January of 1993. Trained by vision in London, she had been a flight attendant with the airline for 3 years. There was an address, a phone number, and a date of birth. Mura Boland was now 31. Robert had written a note beside the phone number. "Tried this," it said. "When I called, no one had ever heard of her." Beneath this information was a list of phone numbers. There were 7 M. Bolands listed in the London directory. Catherine tried to formulate a question, a reasonable request. Did the person answering the phone know of a Jack Lyons? If so, could Catherine ask a question or two? Was that such an unusual thing to ask? Catherine glanced around at the office, at its metallic blandness, its masculine aesthetic. She would not allow herself to believe that Jack had been having an affair. How could she, when she had seen firsthand what happened when a sensational story was woven around only a few facts, as had happened with the press when the CVR tape was leaked? She picked up the telephone and dialed the first number. A man answered, and he sounded as though she had woken him. She quickly calculated the time in London, 9:40 in the morning. She asked if Mura was there. The man coughed into the phone like a heavy smoker. "Who's it you're wanting?" he asked, as if he hadn't heard the question correctly. "Mura Boland," she said. "No Mura Boland's here," the man said confidently. "Sorry," Catherine said and hung up the phone. She crossed out the first number and tried the second. No response. She tried the third number. A man answered in a crisp, businesslike voice. "Michael Boland here," he said, as if expecting a particular call. "Sorry," Catherine said, "wrong number." She crossed out the third number. She tried the fourth number. A woman answered the phone. "Hello?" the woman said. "Hello," Catherine said. "I'm looking for a Mura Boland." The silence at the other end of the line was so complete, Catherine could hear the faint echo of someone else's transatlantic conversation. "Hello?" Catherine tried again. The woman hung up. Catherine sat with the dead receiver to her ear. She picked up the pencil to cross out the fourth number, but then she hesitated. She called the fifth number instead, then the sixth, then the seventh. When she had finished, she looked at her list. On it, she had a man who didn't know Amira, an unanswered number, a Michael Boland businessman, a woman who didn't speak, another unanswered number, a message on an answering machine in an almost unintelligible accent saying that Kate and Murray hoped she would leave a number. a teenage girl who didn't know Amira but said her mother's name was Mary. She tried the fourth number again. "Hello?" the same woman said. "I'm sorry to bother you," Catherine said quickly, before the other woman could hang up, "but I'm trying to locate Amira Boland." Eerily, there was a similar silence to the first. Something was in the background. Music? A dishwasher? And then Catherine heard a small sound from the back of the woman's throat, like the beginning of a word that might be spoken, followed by another silence, shorter this time. "There's no Miura here," the voice said finally. Catherine thought there might have been a delay between her thoughts and her voice, because by the time she opened her mouth to speak, the line had gone dead. When Robert found her in the morning, she was sitting at the table in the front room. The sun had come up, and the snow outside the windows was so blisteringly bright, Robert had to squint to look at her. In the glare, she could see every line and pore on his face. "It's bright in here," he said, turning his head away. "Sometimes you need sunglasses in this room," she said. "Jack used to wear them." She watched as Robert tucked in his shirt. "How'd you sleep?" he asked. "Fine," she said. "And you?" "Great." She could see that he had slept in his clothes. He had probably been too exhausted to get undressed, she thought. Adjusting to the light, Robert seemed to see her face more clearly. "What's wrong?" he asked. Catherine sat forward in the chair. "I'm going to London," she said. He didn't hesitate. He didn't hesitate at all. "I'm going with you," he said. The tablecloths lie spread across the field, a giant's patchwork quilt. Knots of families sit on the cloths with paper plates or real silverware, iced tea and plastic thermoses. Small children run along the grassy pathways, sometimes through the middle of another family's lunch. Catherine opens the picnic basket, an old pie basket of Julia's, and takes out grapes and taro chips, pita bread and hummus, a wedge of brie, and a small rectangle of something smelly. Stilton, she decides, sniffing the cheese. Not far from her, Jack stands talking with two other fathers. The day is overcast, slightly muggy, and already the black flies are annoying. Catherine watches as Jack bends his head and listens to men who are smaller than he is. He has a cup of soda in one hand, the other is in the pocket of his jeans. He laughs and lifts his head, catching Catherine's eye. Behind the laugh, she can see the slight strain of sociability, the good-natured question in his eyes. When will this be over? Farther across the field, Catherine spots Maddie standing in a huddle with a group of friends, her arms crossed and wrapped at her sides as if she were cold, which she is not. It is simply being 15 and not knowing where to put one's hands. Maddie's face, which is familiar and yet not to Catherine, seems a work of art in transition. Its shape newly elongated, the mouth no longer pouty from braces. "Good turnout," Barbara McElroy says from an adjacent blanket. Catherine takes in the McElroy menu at a glance. Fried chicken, supermarket potato salad, coleslaw, Fritos, brownies. "Better than last year," Catherine says. "They'll do the softball game, don't you think? If it doesn't rain." "Maddie's gotten taller," Barbara says, looking in Maddie's direction. Catherine nods. "Is Roxanne here?" she asks, and then wishes she hadn't, for Roxanne, a slender 15-year-old with a lip ring, almost certainly wouldn't be seen at the annual school picnic. Catherine occasionally speaks to the girl, who is wildly truant and heavily endowed with attitude, in the corridors at school. Barbara will be here then for Will, her 7-year-old, Catherine decides. Barbara's husband, Louis, a cod fisherman, is often away, gone for long stretches at a time. Like Jack, Catherine thinks. Your grandmother has a wonderful old pie safe in the window, Joyce Keyes calls from the cloth just beyond Barbara's. Catherine takes in the Keyes picnic as well. Curried rice salad, cold salmon, Perrier, Martha Ingebretson's confit kake. Joyce and her husband James are architects with their own firm in Portsmouth, Keyes and Keyes. The whole social history of the town just in the picnics, Catherine thinks. I haven't seen it, Catherine says. Jack'll play, won't he? Barbara asks. Oh, I think so, Catherine says. She watches her husband dip his head to speak to Arthur Caller, the owner of the mobile station, Jack's sometime tennis partner. It is why his back so often bothers him, she decides. He's always bending to listen to others. He has on a white polo shirt, a pair of boat shoes, another uniform of sorts. He slaps behind his ear, looks at his hand, flicks a black fly from his finger. He sees her watching him. I'm starved, he says, coming to her and lowering himself to the blanket. Should I get Maddie? No, she'll come by when she's ready. You're going to play softball? I guess so, he says, pouring himself another soda. You always think you'll mind and then you love it, she teases. He runs his fingers up and down her back. The touch is unexpected and delicious. She wants to bend her head forward and close her eyes. He hasn't touched her in days. Actually, I could use a nice cold beer right now, he says, dropping his hand. At a school picnic? Doesn't seem to bother Caller. Catherine glances in Arthur Caller's direction and notices now the large red plastic cup in his hand. Catherine hands Jack a half moon of pita bread with hummus inside. Martha said he was going to close the pumps next week, put in new ones. We'll have to go to Ely Falls for gas. Jack nods silently. But of course you won't be here, Catherine says, remembering that Jack will be away for 2 weeks, in London, for his twice annual training session. No, I won't. You know, I could go with you on this one. School ends next Wednesday. I could fly to London and meet you there. We'd have almost a week together. It'd be fun. Jack looks away. The invitation hovers over the tablecloth like cigarette smoke on a wet day. We could leave Maddie with Julia, Catherine adds. Maddie would be thrilled to get rid of us for a week. I don't know, he says slowly, turning back to her. I haven't been to London in ages, she argues, and never for any length of time. He shakes his head. You'd hate it. These training sessions, they're endless. We spend all day in the simulator. We have classes at night. We eat with the British crews. I'd never see you. We wouldn't be able to do anything. I'm pretty good at entertaining myself, she says. And then she wonders suddenly why she needs to argue this proposal at all. Then what's the point of going when I'm over there? He asks somewhat dismissively. You might as well go by yourself. Stung, she bites the inside of her cheek. Listen, he says apologetically. I'd just be frustrated the whole time, knowing you were back in the hotel, knowing we could be doing London together. These sessions are bad enough. I don't think the extra pressure is a good idea. She studies his face, a handsome face, a face people turn to look at when they walk by. I'll tell you what, he says. Why don't you come over at the end of the session and we'll go to Spain? I'll take some time off and we'll fly to Madrid. No, better yet, I'll meet you there. He seems more animated now, relieved to have worked out this compromise. We'll do Barcelona too, he says. Barcelona is great. You've been there? She asks. No, he says quickly. I've just heard about it. She thinks about a trip to Spain with Jack. It would be enjoyable, she knows, but Spain isn't really what she had in mind. Jack will still be away from her for 2 weeks, away from Maddie for longer. She wanted to go to London. Over Jack's shoulder, Catherine can see that Barbara McElroy is watching her intently. Barbara, who knows what it is like to be left for long periods of time. Sounds like a date, Catherine says, forcing a note of cheer. Hey, Lyons, a voice calls from above the blanket. Catherine looks up and squints into the glare of the overcast sky. Sonny Philbrick, a man with a pronounced beer belly under his Patriots t-shirt, kicks Jack playfully in the foot. Hey, Sonny, Jack says. So how's the airline business? Sonny asks. Oh, fine, Jack says. How's the video business? Hanging in there. So where are you off to now? Catherine busies herself with the picnic. Jack draws his feet in from the edge of the tablecloth. He won't stand up, she knows, because he doesn't want to encourage Philbrick. Philbrick's son, who is Maddie's age, is a slight boy with a pretty face, a chess wizard, possibly a prodigy. London, Jack says. London, huh? London, Jack repeats. Catherine can hear the effort to be polite in her husband's voice. They both know where this conversation is going, the same place all of Jack's conversations with men like Philbrick go. For how long? Philbrick asks, looking straight at Catherine. 2 weeks, Jack says. 2 weeks? Philbrick bends backward in mock surprise. You over there with those stewardesses for 2 weeks, man? You better behave yourself. Philbrick winks slyly at Catherine. Philbrick would have been the class bully in school, she decides. Flight attendants, Jack says. Hey, whatever. Actually, Jack says slowly and evenly, I try to screw around as much as I possibly can. For just a second, Philbrick's face loosens with incomprehension. Then he grins, jabs the air with his paper cup. He laughs too loudly, causing others to look up at him from nearby blankets. Lyons, you're something else, you know that? There is an awkward pause then. Jack doesn't respond. Well, see you at the game, Philbrick says. You're gonna play, right? Jack nods, turns toward the picnic basket as if looking for something inside. Catherine watches Philbrick walk away. Jesus, Jack says under his breath. At the gate, they stood apart from the others. Beyond the plate glass windows, large mounds of improbably still white snow stood guard over the apron. Robert had his overcoat folded twice and set upon a molded plastic seat. He had put his overnight bag on top of the coat, something a woman never would have done, Catherine thought, and he was reading the Wall Street Journal. Catherine held her coat over her arm and examined the plane in front of her, tethered to the gate by its accordion umbilical. The plane was pretty, she thought, white with bright red markings, the Vision logo written in a snappy script. The T-900 was angled in such a way that she could see into the cockpit, could see men in shirt sleeves, their faces in shadow, their arms moving along the instrument panel as they worked their way through the checklist. She wondered if she had ever met any of the crew before. Had they come to the memorial service? Her feet hurt and she wanted to sit down. But to do so would have meant sandwiching herself between two overburdened passengers. In any event, there were only minutes left until they boarded.